My guest today is considered by Comedy Central to be one of the 100 greatest stand-ups of all time. She won an American Comedy Award as Best Female Stand-Up. She was the first female to perform stand-up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. She has won 2 Cable Ace Awards, and according to Publishers Clearinghouse, she may be a winner right now. She has won a local Emmy, has written books, voiced numerous animated characters. She's had her own television series on HBO and ABC, and she is coming to the Holland Performing Arts Center Friday, August 24th. I would love to introduce this iconic stand-up comedian. However, we are completely out of time. My guest today is Paula Poundstone.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I've read reviews of you, and I've seen your comedy, and your sharp wit, improvisation with the audience. Due to that, many say you never do the same show twice. So would it be fair to say that if somebody saw you in, I don't know, San Antonio or Poughkeepsie, they should come see you again?
Oh, yeah. People see me all over the country, which I love. People come up to me and they say, we've seen you 5 times, once in Las Vegas, you know, once in Poughkeepsie, once in, and it's always a little creepy because you think, why are they following me? But you could come see my show if on a Thursday and then on a Friday, or even, you know, if I did 2 shows on a Friday. And would it be entirely different? No. But it would be, I'd say 50% of it would be different.
When you do get going and you're really clicking with the audience and there's a lot of give and take going on, how does it feel?
Oh, it's the greatest feeling in the entire world. It's just for a variety of reasons. Probably the greatest of which is that laughter is healing. I consider myself a proud member of the endorphin production industry. It is, and not just, you know what has bugged me for years is this thing, LOL, when somebody types in on their stupid flat thing, LOL. You do not laugh when you're by yourself. You may acknowledge mentally that you think something is funny, but you laugh when you're with other people. That unbridled laughter.
Oh, that's great. I've read in your books that you don't watch live TV, just the videos or the DVDs. And as KIOS-FM is an NPR affiliate, we have the show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. How do you prepare for a current event show like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me without watching the live TV? Where do you...
Oh, I do. I don't watch, like, shows, but I watch the News Hour. I watch the News Hour online, usually, on PBS, and I try to listen to Morning Edition, when I'm up and in the car at the right time. And I'm not proud of this, but I do watch MSNBC sometimes. And the only reason I say I'm not proud of it is because it's, you know, if you ever caught them on a slow news day, the way they sort of all day long are like, keep watching. By the end of the day, you're just a basket case.
That's perfect. You've done this over 30 years. And if they made a Mount Rushmore of comedy, it's you and who are the 3 other comics?
Oh, that's such a great question. Let me think. Okay. Wow. Well, first of all, if they made... Okay, you've already messed up the Mount Rushmore by putting me on it.
I actually think you're the one who could most likely have hair like George's. So if you did
it
right...
Yeah, you couldn't really do my hair in Mountain. You could do it with shrubs. You couldn't do it with Mountain. You could do it in a topiary. I could be done in a topiary. Okay, taking me off... sandblasting me off of Mount Rushmore, I would say Lily Tomlin would belong on Mount Rushmore of comedy. And I think that Robin Williams would because he really made possible many of the performers working today, myself included, by he reinvigorated audiences' interest in stand-up comedy in the late 70s. And it's not that there weren't comics around, there were, but there weren't nearly as many as there are now. I mean, some of us that really aren't all that good get to make a living off of it because Robin generated that excitement about the form. And the other thing he did was he did away with the segue, which, I mean, maybe Robin might have said that Jonathan Winters had already done that, but Robin did it in a way, you know, it used to be that when you were telling a story, you always had to have this linear path of the story. But Robin's a guy who's just over here and over there and over here and over there, and the listener or the viewer got used to that.
And he literally used the line in, and I think it was in the Frisco concert in 84, Silly Rabbit Segways Are for Kids.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's great. I met him in the early 80s sometimes. And, you know, he was very good to me in many, many, many ways. But the truth is, that wasn't unique. It wasn't unique to me. He was really good to lots and lots and lots of us. Comics, young comics. And I was a young comic then. So anyways, he would be on my Mount Rushmore. And Lily, and I don't know. It's a very difficult question. This is part of the reason I've never crafted a Mount Rushmore of comics before. I want to get
somebody. I didn't know,
because
I saw that Carl Reiner did a liner note on your book.
Yes, he did.
I didn't know if Carl.
He should be. You know, I've
heard that Carl and Mel Brooks get together and have dinner 4 or 5 times a week because they're the only two that can make each other laugh.
Isn't that a great image?
Yes, it
yeah.
is. It reminds me of the two old guys from The Muppets.
I don't think they're that cranky yet, but yeah.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, there's something about their longevity that you can't help believing that getting together with someone that makes you laugh four nights a week has got something to do with that, because it's an awfully funny coincidence otherwise.
And if you look at then George Burns, Bob Hope, all those guys that lived up to the night, Milton Berle, the same thing.
Yeah,
They all lived into their 90s.
Well, so much came from Carl Reiner. You're absolutely right. He would, to me, the Dick Van Dyke Show is like my Bible, you know. Sometimes I read from the Book of Buddy. It's so many great things came as a result of just the fact of that show. And I suppose you could go back a little bit further and say so many great things came as the result of the fact of the Sid Caesar show, because so many of those guys that went on to do great things wrote for him. And, of course, Dick Van Dyke was the story of that.
That was another great female comedian, Imogen Coca.
Oh,
out of that as well, right?
I loved her. Loved her. I went to see her and Sid Caesar at a little theater in Westwood. They did a show together. And she was pee your pants funny. She was like the kind of funny where you couldn't breathe.
As you mentioned rather cavalierly.
But by the way, I took us totally off topic, which is part of my problem.
Problem or gift?
No, it's my problem. Socially, it's disastrous. No one likes to get a phone call from me. Whenever I call people, I go, "Hi, it's Paula." They go, "Oh, Paula." And I pick up on it. And then just in terms of, like, my show, I begin the night planning to tell people something, and I never get to it.
You've mentioned the Stooges, the Three Stooges. We just talked about Imogene. So what do you watch to make you laugh? You're like, you know what? I could use a good laugh tonight. It was a tough day. Well, what DVD do you put in? What VHS tape do you pull off the rack?
Well, you know, I have OCD, so I tend to watch the same things over and over again, and they're not necessarily comedy. But many years ago, I was friends with Mary Tyler Moore, and she invited me and my kids to her house when my kids were real little, and then years and years went by where we didn't see each other. We still corresponded, but we didn't see each other. And so one night, like Allie didn't, my middle daughter, she didn't really remember Mary because she hadn't seen her in so many years, but she always knew the story that she'd been to her house, blah, blah, blah. And Allison didn't know the Mary Tyler Moore show. So one night when I felt she was mature enough and ready, I put in a VHS of the Mary Tyler Moore show to show my daughter Allison. And we're watching, and she's enjoying it because she's a human being. And then the tape breaks. And so, yeah, it was a horrifying experience. So that night, I write Mary a letter, and I go, you know, an awful thing has happened. And I tell her, you know, my VHS of the Mary Tyler Moore show, you know, broke. And I swear to you, a couple days later, FedEx. comes a package with I don't know if it's the entire series, but a good portion of it on DVD. Because Mary realized right away the importance of Allie getting to watch the entire Mary. So because I have those that Mary sent me, I do occasionally, in the low ebb of my difficult days, I occasionally will put on a Mary Tyler Moore show or the other one is Dick Van Dyke.
Sure.
And then also my daughter Allie used to request Lucille. I love Lucy's. And I mean, I really am at the point now where I know every word. Like I can say it before they say it. Even the I Love Lucy where they make the film. Ricky has some sort of a. Ricky's supposed to be making a film for an audition for some scout of some sort, and Lucy, of course, feels left out, and so she and Ethel and Fred make this film, but then Lucy edits it incorrectly, and so there's a lot of walking backwards and talking backwards, and I can even do the backwards talk.
That's hilarious. You worked with Ed Asner as well, right?
Yes. We did. He was on a CD that I did, but I've done benefits with Ed. You know, the thing about Los Angeles is every night there's at least, 10 benefits going on somewhere in Los Angeles. And in the circuit of causes and that I run in, there's a lot of usual suspects. So Ed Asner, Mike Farrell, Ed Begley Jr. I could not see those guys socially, although I do see them socially, but I could not see them socially, and I would still see them at least several times a year because we're always at the same the same things. And by the way, all three of them have taken the the privilege of their. Of their fame and done great things with it.
Absolutely. I that is a side note. I got to work with Ed Asner on the John Ritter television show he was on, and he was the nicest man in the world. He made me feel like $1 million. It was really, really quite a privilege.
Yeah, they're guys that really walk the walk, which is nice. I mean, I think Mike Farrell has done. Stuff that that people don't even know about. He'll go for away for a month and breastfeed the mules of nuns in Nicaragua.
He is truly giving from the heart here.
No, he does. He gives. He does. No, he's a guy who just. I had a ping pong party on June 30th, and Mike was going to come. And then he writes me and he says, listen, I just am so upset about the kids at the border. He says, I have to go somewhere and protest. I can't go to a party. So, he really is a guy who puts his his nipples where his mouth is, which makes him look weird.
It does.
Putting your
it
nipples
does.
Where your mouth is. Yeah, he's almost Picasso-esque when you look at him.
But the man is a tribute to mammals.
Honestly, he really is. He really is. And I'll tell you something. You know, Ed Begley Jr. and his buddies, he grew up in the Valley and in Los Angeles. Him and his buddies years ago are the guys that became activists and got the, smog producers to stop and changed, things like how cars were made, blah, blah, blah. And they really changed the lives of everyone in this area.
Right. I mean, and Ed's the guy that, with all the success he has from a financial standpoint, it's the guy who still hops on his bike to go somewhere. He doesn't hop in a car. He hops on his bike and he rides there.
No, that's how we met. We were both doing an event for Heal the Bay in Los Angeles. And I heard, Begley's going to be late because he rode his bike. And so I think I had to go on before him or cover for him or something. And I went on and I said, You know, Ed Begley riding his bike here, making everyone feel like an huh? I've never liked that guy. He just made, you know, I'll tell you something. He has a metal straw. Ed Begley carries a metal straw. He needs to be stopped. No, he's done such great work. And again, it's not just bringing attention to the problems, which has been great, but he, you know, so, but he's really, yeah, he really does it. He used to have a thing in his house where he had a bicycle, a stationary bicycle, that he pumped energy into a battery or into a generator that helped run his house. And so I used to ask for my food to be well cooked just so that he had to ride more.
You know what? You're doing him a favor, saving his heart, believe me.
Yeah, I'd say, Ed, geez, it's a little hot in here, isn't it? Could you get on the bike and get that AC going?
Can you explain for everybody listening the difference between a HEP versus a Baloo of happiness?
Oh, yes, yes. A HEP of happiness, there's about four HEPs in a Baloo. I see it as, and these are measures of happiness, which when I went to write my book, which is titled The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, and my book is a series of experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. And every chapter is written as an experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and the variables and the qualitative and quantitative observations and the field notes, etc. But what I realized when I first started writing was, like, you know, we don't have a measure. You know, we don't have, you know, beyond the word really, which is subjective, we don't have a measure of happiness, of how to measure it. And so I came up with this rather loose standard, which is a Baloo of happiness is a lot. And a HEP of happiness is about a fourth of that. So four HEPs and you got yourself a nice Baloo.
Kids and technology in education. What is your take on this?
Finally the world of brain science is beginning to say these things. The Pediatric Association has begun to say these things. Developing brains do not belong in front of a screen device. And, you know, the truth is we really don't know yet the full level of damage that's being done by what we're doing in terms of... somebody tweeted me the other day, ironically, a picture of like a potty training seat for a kid with a rack on it to hold an iPad. And not only that, I looked it up later, and I found that there were like three or four different companies that made rival products of this. First of all, if you're a parent and you have a kid who's toilet training, you know, it's a little bit of a challenge in that you have to sort of be ready to stick and move at the drop of a hat. I mean, the truth is, a kid in diapers is a lot more convenient in some ways than a kid toilet training. But if you are going to have some of the best conversations you will ever have with that child in your entire life while they sit on the toilet. There's something about the process where you're both stuck that just makes these conversations that are wonderful. And so in addition to the fact that the iPad is bad for the developing brain and you don't want your kid looking at it, and certainly not when they're sitting on the toilet, for heaven's sakes, but in addition to that, you are losing this opportunity of wonderful, wonderful conversations. There, you know, when you think about it in terms of elementary school in particular, I could see by high school having, you know, like a computer class. Fine. Great. Do that. We learned to type when I was growing up, and we didn't carry the typewriters around all day. So put it in a classroom with a locked door. When they have computer class, they go in and they use it. And outside of that, screen devices, iPads, individual laptops, smartphones should not be tolerated in the schools because they do brain damage. This is documented now. This is, I'm not like some nutter saying this. I'm Bartholomew of Bartholomew and the Ublick. I am trying to bring people's attention. We have been sold a bill of goods. And the reason I know this is my son, who is now 20, I put him in front of a computer when he was 3 because I thought what we all thought. I thought I was giving him a leg up. I thought I was, you know, helping him. And it turns out it was disastrous. He became a very severe electronics addict, which is a real thing. They finally, the World Health Organization came out, like in December, I think it was, and said that video game addiction is a mental health disorder. But the United States has been very slow to cop to these things. And some people who work for these businesses, like I think it was a guy from Google maybe, and I know there's been an Apple guy, that started doing the, you know, the sort of talk news circuit telling that the companies knew that they purposely made these things addictive and that it's not just us.
Oh, sure. They pick color patterns and color combinations that are addictive. It's not
every last thing they could do. Yeah, every last nuanced thing that they could do. And by the way, I don't think anything has ever worked as effectively. I'm sure they're all patting themselves on the back. It was genius. The problem is it was like Simon Bart Sinister genius, which is he was the one of the bad guys in Underdog. He used, you'll recall, the shrinking gun.
Yes.
Yeah, made everybody very small for quite a while. And basically, these tech companies have used the shrinking gun. And here's something else to keep in mind. When your kid is using, they find now, we have the highest instance of depression in, like, little kids that we have had since those sorts of numbers have been recorded. And you know, it just can't be a coincidence that this major, you know, life change of these electronics have shown up, you know, and then this thing followed. But I heard this great thing because I was at a conference on this topic in Boston just a couple months ago. I heard somebody say this great thing. If your kid is engaged in video gaming and watching stuff constantly with carrying a screen around and the like, their own imagination is not developing because they're putting themselves in someone else's imagination instead of developing their own. And they said this great thing, which is hope requires imagination.
Absolutely. Let me ask you something, because you brought up an interesting point. You mentioned Underdog, and was that kind of a subconscious way of saying that Wally Cox makes the Mount Rushmore?
I hadn't even thought of that, but perhaps he should.
Maybe.
That's why he was Underdog, wasn't he, Wally Cox?
He was. Yes,
oh, my
was.
Gosh, I love. There was something so wonderful about the simplicity of Riff Raff, who is one of the... I had the Underdog board game when I was a kid. I had Underdog... I had a set of Underdog playing cards, and... looking back, Trump may have been on there.
Fair enough. A reminder to everybody, Paula Poundstone coming to the Holland Performing Arts Center Friday, August 24th. You can get your tickets at paulapoundstone.com, or for more information, you go to ticketomaha.com as well. We hope to see you there. Thank you, Paula.
All right, Mike, thank you so much. Mucho apreciado.